We're delighted to welcome all of you today, but especially some students and that we have with us today. We have with us Ryo High School students. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And Brown Deer High School students, if they'd stand, please. Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And we have some Department of Justice externs. Would they stand, please? Thank you for coming. The high school students are here with a national award-winning program called Court with Class. It's sponsored by the State Bar of Wisconsin and the Supreme Court. We invite high school students from around the state to come and join us. And if the school agrees that the students will appear, the students are given briefs of the case we are about to hear. They may engage in some activities relating to the case, come to the court, listen to oral argument, and meet with a justice at noon after the second case is argued. Everyone is invited to attend the session with the justice. The session deals with the procedures of the court, not the substantive issues of the cases. Does anyone here want a summary of the case we're about to hear? If you have a summary or you're not familiar with the case, it's better to have this summary. If you raise your hand. All right. Let me introduce the court to you all. On my far left is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice Patience Rogensack. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crux. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To her right, Justice David Prosser. David Prosser is the justice with whom you will meet at noon. And on the far right is Justice Lewis Butler. With those introductory comments made, I will now call our first case for today, Hans Rex Steiner. Oh, I'm sorry. That's what the I go through this by rote, and so if there's an empty chair, I won't notice because I assume someone is sitting in it. But I've been reminded by Justice Crooks that there is an empty chair where Lewis Butler generally sits, but he will not be participating in this case. Now I'm going to call the case. 06-AP-1521, Hans Rex Steiner versus Hazelden et al. Arguing on behalf of Hans Rex Steiner will be James Drill, but let me say Attorney Ferguson is going to argue on behalf of Spooner Health for 15 minutes, and Attorney Bjorkman is going to argue on behalf of Hazelden. Okay. And then, Mr. Drill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. You may proceed, Mr. Drill.
My name is Jim Drill. I'm from New Richmond, Wisconsin, and represent the plaintiff, Hans Rex Steiner. Very short review of what went on in the courts below and prior to the commencement of the litigation. As a result of an evaluation of Dr. Rex Steiner, which was requested by the Spooner healthcare system, and I'm going to refer to Spooner including all of the defendants, some individually named, and the institution itself. As a result of the evaluation at Hazelden Treatment Center, which evaluation was requested by Spooner, Dr. Rex Steiner was diagnosed as alcohol dependent when, in fact, he was not alcohol dependent. The result of that assessment was that Dr. Recksteiner spent 28 days of confinement, so to speak, at that institution as an inpatient, and many months of aftercare, which caused a significant economic loss to him and damage to his personal and professional reputation. The causes of action that we brought were against Spooner, including some individuals, as I said, alleging defamation. The action against Hazelden was for negligence in their diagnosis of Dr. Recksteiner's situation, namely the finding that he was alcohol dependent, which we contend was not supported by their own records. He did not meet the criteria for one who is alcohol dependent. Subsequently, as the record shows, Hazelden reversed their diagnosis months after Dr. Recksteiner had been treated and months after he had commenced aftercare. That reversal of their determination was after he wrote a letter to Hazelden, having learned from other alcohol experts, I'll call them, that indeed he was not alcohol dependent. He never believed that he was alcohol dependent.
Counselor, if I could just interrupt you a bit. Usually when we have a medical malpractice claim and there's a claim of lost income, it follows a physical injury which resulted from the malpractice. So your theory is a little bit different because you aren't claiming he suffered any physical injury, are you, from the treatment that was given to him?
That's correct.
How do you jump over that step then in malpractice with showing that type of injury? What are you relying on to be able to eliminate any kind of physical harm from the treatment that was given and just jump right to some kind of economic harm?
I don't know that it's a that I would characterize it as a jump, but this is a negligence action. It doesn't matter whether we call it malpractice, which is a term that I generally don't use. I rather use medical negligence in those kind of situations because that's what it is negligence. And the negligence caused harm. We don't believe that it's necessary that negligence cause physical harm. And as a consequence of that finding, because of the relationship of Dr. Recksteiner with Spooner, they required that he follow any recommendation of that institution, Hazelden, and therefore he could not practice medicine during that period of time in the Spooner system where he had been for decades.
But Counselor, when he asked to have the diagnosis reviewed, and Hazelden did a review and adjusted the diagnosis as you've explained, they also specifically said that given the indicia of his alcohol use, they would have recommended the same treatment, the 28 days, as a inpatient. How do you get around that in your claim that the misdiagnosis caused a wrong treatment to be applied?
The way around it is that it's an issue of fact for the trier of fact, because there are conflicting opinions relative to that subject of what we've called causation and what the lower courts called causation. That is, even if he was diagnosed as one who had abused alcohol on occasion, Hazelden said in their letter that they would have recommended the same treatment. We do not believe that. We believe that letter was damage control on the part of Hazelden, because they recognized that they had been negligent in making that diagnosis. There are contrary opinions on that subject, and we believe that it is a genuine issue of fact. In the extreme case, the letter from Scott Hansen says that in all the years that he has been dealing with that kind of difficulty of people, inpatient care simply is not used for someone who is not alcohol dependent in that circumstance.
Just so that I may be clear then, you believe that the affidavit submitted on behalf of Rex Steiner does create a genuine issue of material fact?
Yes.
I thought this case was going to talk about 146.37, immunity.
Yes.
That's the defense here, right?
Yes.
All right. 146.37.1G grants immunity to any person acting in good faith. Let's just assume Spooner and Hazelden all acted in good faith for the moment. Any person who participates in the review or evaluation of the services of health care providers. And your client is a health care provider. No question about that.
Correct.
Conducted in connection with any program organized and operated to help improve the quality of health care. Did Spooner have a program organized and operating to help improve the quality of health care in the hospital?
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
Spooner.
Yes.
Have a program under the statute organized and operated to help improve the quality of health care in its institution?
They did.
They did. Okay. And their checking on your client was part of that program, right? You got a surgeon who's on 24/7. Every day of the year, right?
Correct.
Because he's the only surgeon in town, right?
At that time,
apparently,
correct.
Right. And they find out that he's drinking. It's not over the limit, but he's found with alcohol, right?
Correct.
Okay. So they're conducting a review to see if... he's got a problem, alcohol problem, and what they should do about it, right?
They took action, yes.
Okay, so they sent him to Hazelden, right?
Correct.
For an evaluation, right?
Correct.
Was that evaluation covered, in your opinion, under 146.37.1G?
Absolutely not.
Why not?
Because there was never any evaluation of the services of Hans Rex Steiner with respect to his patients. There was never one intended. It was not carried out. There was no peer review. And I must mention, and this is a good time to do it, that the Court of Appeals opinion stated that the plaintiff did not contend that this was not peer review. That is simply inaccurate. We have contended that this was not peer review under that statute from the inception of these legal proceedings. Secondly, I must point out that on page 23 of Hazelden's brief in this court, it is asserted that we concede that this was a peer review. This is totally inaccurate. If you've read our briefs, so you know that we do not so concede. What we referred to on page 17 of our brief that Hazelden's brief pointed out was that after an amendment to the statute following the Moroni case, it was made clear that hospitals as an institution could conduct peer review. We don't believe they did in this case. That's the fairest assessment I can give of what's in those briefs. So,
well, if I understand your argument, Mr. Drill, you're saying, or I'm translating what you're saying to mean, that peer review says I have to look and see whether Rex Steiner negligently treated Mr. Smith. That's peer review. And there was no allegation here that your client engaged in any poor medical treatment. Therefore, you're saying this isn't peer review. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. And
well, exactly, but just because a doctor hasn't engaged yet in malpractice, but has an addiction, and I'm not saying your client does, and that's not what I'm asking you, but suppose let's concede a person has a drug addiction, okay? Then my question is, even though he hasn't injured anyone yet, don't you think the hospital under peer review should check him out to make sure, to see whether he does have an addiction, whether he has whether that addiction affects him? Let's say he's on 9 to 5. Don't you think that's part of peer review?
I think that they have a right to check him out, as Your Honor states, but it doesn't have to be in parameters of peer review, and this was not a peer review. They simply said that under their policy, they insisted that he be evaluated and that if he refused, his privileges would be suspended. No one challenges, least of all not us, that the hospital had the right to do that. It was okay for them to request that he have an evaluation. That doesn't make it peer review, because
okay,
peer review relates to the investigation of the treatment of a physician or of patients of the physician. And the statute, a plain reading of the statute says that. So,
Mr. Drill,
let
me ask you, for dealing with the policy involved, If Dr. Recksteiner could be subject to review as to whether he had some kind of a drinking problem, and let's say I am asked to give my opinion on that, why shouldn't I have immunity if I give an honest answer and act in good faith?
For the same reason that I've given before, Justice, that is that either it is a peer review or it is not a peer review. And peer review connotes an evaluation of the competence of the physician in his treatment of his patients. That's what peer review is all about. We believe that was the intent of the statute. We believe it's the plain meaning of the words in the statute. And there never has been any claim that even that he had ever treated a patient after having alcohol, let alone mistreated a patient. And so the only way I can respond to that is to say that the statute relates to an evaluation of Dr. Recksteiner's competence in his treatment of the patients that he has had. Talk about Hazelden for a moment. Hazelden they have no people there who ever addressed his treatment of his patients. They never addressed it. There can't be a peer review unless that's what's going on. So we say.
Well, let me ask this. Was he on duty the day of the snowmobile incident?
Was he on duty?
Yeah.
Yes.
Suppose you had
been... So far as I recall, and let's assume for the moment he was.
Suppose you had been in Spooner that day and suddenly had something that required emergency surgery. Would you have wanted a doctor with a .06 to be operating on you?
Probably not.
Well, if you were a hospital administrator, wouldn't you have wanted to be able to kind of oversee the condition of the surgeon under your jurisdiction?
Absolutely. I think they have a right to oversee the physicians on their staff. I should point out that I don't know, as a fact, that Dr. Rex Steiner would have performed surgery on someone that night. He was on call, we've assumed, but there are other surgeons, not in that town at that time, but in the area, who could have been called upon to do it if he said he could not.
Didn't he give assistance, medical assistance, to the person who was injured?
Yes, and I hesitate to say, because I'm not sure it's in the record, but he did render service and possibly save the man's life.
And my reading of the briefs was that there's no complaint against him for anything he did that night.
No complaint about his treatment of any patient ever.
If I understand your argument, you are just saying that the plain reading of 146.37 is that it's a review or evaluation of the services of healthcare providers, the services.
Yes, or it charges therefore.
What charges therefore? So they're looking for improper utilization of services or facilities, they're determining reasonable charges, et cetera. And that doesn't cover the general condition of this physician. He may be in bad shape physically, he may be bad shape emotionally, he may be addicted, if he's carrying on and there's no complaint about his services, it doesn't come under 1G, even though the hospital should check him out and does check him out, but they're not immune. That's your argument, isn't it, under 1G?
It is.
You'd protect Dr. House, then.
Pardon me? Oh, Dr. House? Yes.
Who sure. At least sometimes is viewed as addicted. Yes, okay. I just wanted to know.
Yes,
all
indeed.
Right.
But see, there's a remedy. They have a remedy. They don't have to employ this physician.
Hospital can get rid of them.
They have
Is
a remedy.
A contract?
Sure. He was an independent contractor. He was not employed by the hospital. They don't have to employ him. They don't have to have him on their staff.
Well, he still has the bylaws, though, of the hospital to rely on, and I don't know what your bylaws look like in the hospital. Most bylaws give the physician some protection from arbitrary dismissal.
We haven't addressed that here,
right.
And I don't know that such a fact existed, but we do know that he was not an employee of the hospital. They didn't have to employ him if they didn't want to.
Well, let's
a suggestion.
Let me just assume for the moment, for purposes of argument, that the evaluation does come under 146.37(1)(g). I want to move down now to the treatment, okay?
Okay.
And that just deals with Hazelden, right?
Yeah.
All right. And suppose, for the sake of argument, we agree that he abused alcohol but was not addicted, okay? Or whatever the terminology is. And let us assume that there was inappropriate treatment. That is, it took too long, he was taken out of circulation, etc. The Court of Appeals seems to have some discussion about whether malpractice in connection with treatment comes under 146.37(1)(g). What's your position on that?
They did more than raise the question. They held that the conduct of Hazelden, if proved and if causation was proved, is not protected by this statute, and they are not immune. The court held that. The annotations under that statute are replete with references to that published opinion of the Court of Appeals in this case. There's 7 or 8 cites in the annotations to that effect. Not to that effect, I mean on various subjects, but the Court of Appeals did hold that Hazelden did not enjoy the immunity if negligence can be proved and causation can be proved.
But you got summary judgment against you.
Yes. We have summary judgment against us as to all defendants because the Court of Appeals, as well as the trial court, weighed the evidence and concluded that we could not prove a causal relationship based on the letter of Hazelden alone.
You think you should get a trial? Did you ask for a jury in this case?
Yes. I'm going to address that subject again in a moment. I did want to say quickly that there's a suggestion in the briefs, and perhaps will be an argument, that Dr. Recksteiner waived his legal rights by acquiescing to this evaluation. That's an absurd assertion. Here's a man who for decades has served this hospital when he was in town 24 hours a day. Never a claim that he mistreated a patient or failed to treat a patient properly. He has a choice. He gets this letter. Either his career is finished in that community, or he goes and has this evaluation, hoping that he will be vindicated because he believes he is not alcohol dependent. And the suggestion that he's waived his legal rights because of that, we believe, is absurd. He had an unending resolve to be vindicated here, as evidenced by him writing to Hazelden afterward and saying, in effect, you made a mistake, and I want this off my record. Now, if we assume that peer review does apply to these facts, where do we stand then? We have to address that. And it's our response to it is simple. This record has differing opinions about the negligence of Hazelden, about the good faith or bad faith of the Spooner people, and this is a question of fact for the jury. We have, with respect to any bad faith issues, the burden of clear and convincing evidence. We don't have that burden at summary judgment, according to at least one case. We have to have enough in the record to show that a jury could find, by clear and convincing evidence, that there was a breach of the obligation of good faith on the part of Spooner, now I'm talking about, in their conduct surrounding this evaluation.
Counselor, we haven't talked at all about the libel and the slander claims that were made, and apparently they were based on statements that had little to do with his patient care, but had more to do perhaps with his personality. Yet my understanding that all of these comments were not published by the hospital. How do you get to get these comments to come outside of the peer review? Is it just because you say this wasn't peer review at all, or is there something else that attaches to these comments that would permit you to continue on with a claim for libel or slander?
This is a small town. The folks on this board were members of the community. This wasn't their full-time job. We believe that we will be able to prove, if permitted to go to trial, that this information, these accusations, were disseminated in the community. I can't point a finger at somebody right now, but we have alleged that his reputation in the community was damaged, and we have a right to bring that issue before a jury, we believe. I'm now on this subject of the assumption that the Chief Justice asked us to make that this is covered by peer review.
Sure, I understand.
All right. With respect to Spooner, I've already spoken that we have a certain burden. We think there are issues of fact for the jury that an appellate court, indeed not even a trial court, has any business looking at the evidence on both sides and trying to resolve who wins. And that's exactly what happened here. And that's impermissible in a trial court or in an appellate court, we believe. With respect to Hazleton, the Court of Appeals has proclaimed an exception to this statute and the immunity that attaches when you're operating under this statute. They say that Hazleton is not immune. The Court of Appeals says that. However, this is difficult to understand, this concept, for me, frankly, because we know that for certain that immunity can't be universal. If a patient is sent to Hazleton for an evaluation and treatment pursuant to a peer review situation, and he's medicated, and he is accidentally or negligently given the wrong medication to which he's allergic, and he dies, are we going to say they are immune from suit under the peer review statute? Incomprehensible. It's a very difficult concept, because what this Court of Appeals did demonstrates, I think, that this was not peer review at all.
Mr. Drell, your red light is on. You have
several. Oh, it certainly is.
And several moments for rebuttal.
Pardon me?
You will have several moments for rebuttal.
Several moments. Okay, thank you.
Attorney Ferguson, representing Spooner Health.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Sally Ferguson, and I represent all of the Spooner respondents. Spooner Health System, the board of directors, William Stewart III, Judy Kusky, Maxine Long, and Mike Schaefer. Brief review of the facts. Spooner Health System was provided with a sheriff's report, and that sheriff's report indicated that its only on-call surgeon had a blood alcohol of 0.06. Their only on-call surgeon at that time could not recite the alphabet without slurring his speech. When presented with this information, they compared the conduct with their bylaws, and they informed Dr. Recksteiner that he had two choices. One was to take a voluntary leave, and the other was to undergo an assessment, an alcohol assessment, or his hospital privileges would be suspended. A meeting was held, and Dr. Recksteiner was informed that a five-day assessment appointment had been made and paid for by Spooner. Dr. Recksteiner chose to undergo the assessment. Spooner sent a letter to Dr. Recksteiner and said in that letter, dated March 14, 2003, which is part of the record, "The board is taking this action in the belief that the board has obtained the relevant facts and that its action is warranted by those facts and in furtherance of quality health care." During the course of this assessment, Dr. Recksteiner authorized Hazleton to consult with people at Spooner who knew him both through work and socializing. It's during the course of these confidential conversations that Dr. Recksteiner alleges he was defamed. None of those statements were ever published any place other than his medical record. To date, those records remain private and confidential. It's Spooner's position that this falls clearly within peer review. And we point back to the statute. The statute is very clear on this. No person acting in good faith who participates in the review or evaluation of the services of health care providers to help improve the quality of health care. All Spooner had in mind was the concern of their patients who present at the emergency room for surgery. They're on notice that their only on-call surgeon is 0.06, can't recite the alphabet without slurring, and can't find a pulse on the patient.
You know, I what you're saying sort of makes sense. And if you tell somebody this hospital knows that they've got a doctor on call and the doctor is incapacitated even slightly by alcohol, that the hospital's obligation is to look into it. I mean, I don't think people would disagree about that. As a fact, if I understand Mr. Drill, he accepts that. His client accepts that it was your obligation to make sure he's competent.
Correct.
Your position is great, but it doesn't come under 146.371G, in that what you're doing is you're reading out the word services of healthcare providers, and you're putting in the general competence of healthcare providers, even though there's no evidence that there's anything the matter in the services provided.
The question is, his services at the time he's an on-call surgeon, he's 0.06. In our view and in comparison with the statute, those are his services. We can't wait for a bad outcome. You can't wait for the surgeon who has a tremor to have a bad outcome, a surgeon who has narcolepsy, a surgeon who we know has an alcohol issue when he's on call. We are evaluating his services, and it falls under the plain language of the statute.
I would imagine that just because of the general population, that there are a number of doctors, a number of surgeons who are bipolar. And, of course, bipolar is manifested in varying degrees. What do you do if a doctor is bipolar and maybe the manifestation, you see him at the grocery store, there's a bit of a manifestation there. And yet there's never been a complaint about his mental health status vis-a-vis treatment of patients. How does that play out?
I think the issue is the manifestation occur while he's providing services?
Well, he's on call.
And if he's on call and that's manifested, I think that falls under peer review, just like this. This doctor is on call. We are not going and looking for his alcohol use while he's not on call. It's brought to our attention while he's on call. That goes to his services, his ability to work as a surgeon at that time.
So if a doctor is bipolar and is on call, does this mean that there should a hospital, for instance, should initiate some kind of peer review for any mentally ill doctor?
If there's a manifestation of something while he's on call, I think that's what the statute calls for.
I mean, I would assume it's correct to say that you're bipolar 24/7, right?
And consult with the experts to see what the experts say about the ability of that surgeon to work.
Even though there's been no complaint. And I'm not saying that I'm just asking you the contours of your argument. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. I mean, from a potential patient, I'd say, hey, that's right. No. I want my doctor being in the best of health, right? But that isn't the question. The question that we're focusing on is peer review is defined in 146.37.
And I think from your question, it was the manifestation of some bipolar issue with that could cause the peer review process to be initiated. Just as in this case, it was the report from the sheriff of this on-call surgeon being 0.06 that caused us to initiate peer review and look at his services.
So if there's a real hyperactivity, for instance, which is a symptom sometimes of bipolar, and no and in my hypothetical, no connection with any mistreatment of a patient, there still should be review by a hospital, I don't disagree with that, but that any review, even if it may not be dealing with
services provided is still subject to immunity?
Yes, because what you're doing is trying to improve the quality of health care, which is the other part of the statute.
But you need both. I mean, you need the immunity, as I understand it, is for those who participate in the review or evaluation of services of the health care provider or facilities or the charges for such services. Are you reading these services then to be, it could be for potential future services?
Yep.
In my bipolar hypothetical?
Absolutely.
So it doesn't have to be dealing with any specific services or charges. There could be someone with no complaints, exemplary service, number one, reviewed, no problem with that. But number two, there's immunity that attaches. So
that's correct.
So you're reading this as, let me see, who participates in the review or evaluation of services.
Potential services.
Potential services. Hmm? Or future services.
For example, in this case, if Dr. Recksteiner had to perform surgery at 3:45 that morning, those would be potential future services, and that's what caused the concern in this case.
But in your what we're here doing is interpreting a statute.
Correct.
And your argument really doesn't make any difference if the surgery is 3:45 that morning or 3:45 5 months from now.
That's correct.
That's right. So that has... The temporal nature has nothing to do in terms of immediate temporal. You're talking about any future services. The statute intends that there be immunity for review for any potential services.
That's future. Correct, especially with these facts, which are egregious.
Counsel, you rely on that because of the forward-looking words in the statute, which are to help improve the quality of health care. Meaning you can't improve what's already happened, but you can look forward and improve what may happen in the future.
That's correct. And that's what this Supreme Court said in the Hofflander case.
Mm-hmm. What's the purpose of immunity here?
To allow organizations such as Spooner to consult with experts to improve the quality of health care without concern about what might happen, such as in this case. Should they be... subject to defamation for have reported to the experts their observations of their on-call surgeon? No.
Are there any other claims against Spooner other than defamation?
No, those are the only claims.
So they're not, there's no malpractice claim that they told you to go to, Spooner told them to go to Hazleton. Hazleton is alleged to have engaged in malpractice, so you're not part of that. They
no.
didn't say, well, you're liable, too, because you recommended Hazleton, right?
That's correct. They're okay. saying we're not immune because Hazleton's not immune, but the only claim against Spooner is defamation.
Defamation. Okay. Mm-hmm.
If the doctor had been called upon to do surgery and he said, I think I might have had a little bit too much to drink, where would the hospital have turned for another surgeon?
I don't know the answer to that. He was the only on-call surgeon at that time, and presumably they would have had to go to another community. I don't know the answer to
well,
that.
Well, what other communities would have had surgeons?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Hayward had a surgeon. I don't know if he would have had to go to another facility because they didn't have another surgeon. They now do, but at that time they did not.
Well, with all due respect... I'm not sure I would have wanted to be Dr. Recksteiner, serving for 20-some years and basically being told, you really can never drink. You're always on call.
That wasn't the situation here. In fact, there had been other concerns about drinking. What brought this issue to the forefront was the sheriff's report of a specific incident. It was a choice he made to be an on-call surgeon at Spooner, where he was on call 24/7. But the conduct that was brought to their attention caused the need for immediate peer review.
Well, did they just ignore all the other prior incidents that indicated he was drinking?
I don't know that the record indicates that it was ignored. It was an issue, and that's in the record.
But there are prior incidents.
There was a prior concern about his drinking while on call.
Mm-hmm. Counsel, what, if any, effect do you think it has on the fact that the physician was given choices? Voluntarily leave, get the alcohol assessment, or you're suspended?
I think it does have a significant impact. You know, his claim now is that we're not entitled to immunity because we engaged Hazleton. He was given the choice of taking a voluntary leave, and his privileges would have been suspended. He chose to undergo the alcohol assessment, and I think that is significant.
Thank you.
Can the consumer somehow look up what the results of a particular surgeon's performance is? Well, let's say this guy right here. I want to engage him as my surgeon. Can I evaluate what his performance is?
I think the public has access to recorded incidents through a national data bank. What an individual surgeon's rate of success, I don't know that can be reviewed, but certainly incidents that are reported can be reviewed by a consumer.
Did Dr. Recksteiner have a shaky evaluation on the basis of the statistics?
I don't think that is part of the record.
Should it be?
Not for these purposes. I think the only issue before the court today is Spooner and Hazleton, who they consulted with as experts, entitled to immunity for trying to improve the quality of healthcare services at their facility, which is what they did, only because it was brought to their attention. They weren't out looking for reasons to look into Dr. Recksteiner's drinking. It was brought to their attention, and they acted appropriately and should be entitled to immunity under the statute. As to the issue, the other issue raised by the plaintiff is that there was bad faith. He hasn't produced the evidence of that.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Bjorkman, you are going to your license in Minnesota, is that correct, but not in Wisconsin? Counsel, Mr. Solheim.
Good morning. My name is Mark Solheim, and I'd like to introduce Louise Bjorkman, my partner, to present the argument on behalf of Hazleton.
Thank you. Ms. Bjorkman, you're licensed and presently in good standing in Minnesota?
It is.
You're admitted for purposes of this argument only. You may proceed, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Louise Devery Bjorkman. I represent defendant respondent Hazleton. As this court stated in the Hofflander case, the peer review immunity statute, like its privilege counterpart, furthers an important public policy of encouraging hospitals to perform quality control reviews aimed at improving prospectively their services. Spooner Hospital's decision to enlist my client's assistance in evaluating whether a surgeon's drinking while on call was impacting the quality of the service he was able to provide and determining what, if anything, could be done to improve his future services presents precisely the type of conduct that the immunity statute is designed to protect. I think by the court's questioning and from what we've heard today, the issue boils down to how does the statute define the term services? Recksteiner would have this court limit that to the technical aspects of a physician or other medical provider's services. I suggest that you need look no further than the facts of this particular case to reach the conclusion that such a limit is not warranted and would be against public policy.
Is it your position that Hazleton would have immunity under 146.37 for any diagnosis or treatment or conduct that went on while the plaintiff was at Hazleton? How broad is this immunity that you're seeking?
breadth, the scope of the immunity is broad, and what I would say in direct response is that we need to focus on the facts of this case. And I don't mean to deny the answer, but the question here, the issue here, as framed by Rex Steiner, is very simple.
Well, let me, scope of immunity is, you know, like, ooh, that's big stuff. And so we've got to make sure that when there is immunity, that it's that's follows and tracks the statute. Here, as I understand it, that the Court of Appeals, the linchpin of the Court of Appeals with regard to Hazleton is that, okay, you know, maybe Hazleton didn't review the services, you know, didn't review charges, but it participated, you know, it piggybacked along with the review done by Spooner. Let me give you a hypothetical. Tell me how it works out. This, and Hazleton, of course, is a well-recognized institution. Let me go a little bit smaller, local Wisconsin. Emergency MedTech, that's a healthcare provider for purposes of this statute under the definition. And it's at MedTech at the Merrill Community Hospital in Wisconsin. And maybe the MedTech is on call and is drinking and they want to do some peer review. And they're concerned that when he picked up this patient and responded, he was drinking. So they send, same kind of facts here, and they send him to not Hazleton, but Sacred Heart Hospital in Tomahawk, which is an all-purpose hospital, but does have a wing or kind of a little bit of an emphasis on alcohol treatment. And let's say during the course of him being at Sacred Heart, they do some procedure that causes him great harm. They give him some wrong medication that causes him great physical injury, just, you know, real obvious malpractice. Are they immune since he is there participating in peer review?
I would say that is a much closer case, and again, not the facts of this case. The difference here, and I think what the Court of Appeals noted, was that the treatment and the claims related to the treatment, and the point I wish to leave the Court with, probably chief amongst any, is that Rex Steiner's beef here is with the diagnosis. It isn't with the treatment. But if there is a failure of treatment, if there is a physical injury that is caused by malpractice, that really isn't part of how are we evaluating, then they may be able to go forward with the malpractice claim. I do not believe that the lower court's decisions here say that forever and at no time will there ever be recovery for a garden variety malpractice claim.
Okay, and I'm going to use Mr. Drill's language, a garden variety maybe, but negligence claim. Negligence claim here. You know, there's the cause of action that there was a...
and I would say
injury and damages.
There could be a negligence claim if it arises out of treatment and failures in the treatment that aren't part of an evaluative process. That is not the situation we find ourselves in this case.
Okay, let me just push you a little bit further. You're saying that there could be a cause of action for negligence in diagnosis or treatment, even though he's at Sacred Heart for peer review, and even though they thought they were giving him a sleeping pill or something to take care of his anxiety, and that was a different, you know, some kind of a psychotropic medication or something, that there still could be a cause of action for their negligence in diagnosis or treatment, even if he's there for peer review but they do something else?
There would not be a cause of action for negligent diagnosis to the extent that the diagnosis and evaluation is part of the process. I think we need to go back to the statute, and we're looking at a person. Are they acting in good faith in furtherance of the review or evaluation of the services to help, you know, improve the quality of health care? The diagnostic piece, when it is done under, again, the unique circumstances that you posit and that are presented in this case, that diagnosis is part of the evaluative process. And as the Harris Court said, the Seventh Circuit applying Wisconsin's peer review immunity statute, to the extent that a physician's or med techs' substance use is impacting their ability to perform services, and clearly it's one of the factors in how you're able to deliver care, then evaluation of that condition or diagnosis of that condition falls within the peer review statute. If the treating people give the wrong medication or let somebody escape and they're killed in a car accident, that's farther removed, and I think it presents a different set of facts, and the court would have to look long and hard at whether that is a person acting in good faith and doing the review and evaluation process. But this particular case does not present that situation, and there's no need. The Court of Appeals did not establish such a rule, and there's no need for the court in this case to go beyond the issue of negligent diagnosis.
Counsel, my understanding is that Mr. Drill is arguing, because this matter comes before us on summary judgment, that there is indeed a genuine issue of material fact. And he says that genuine issue of material fact relates to whether or not there was indeed the necessity for the 28-day inpatient treatment, and I understand some 12-week follow-up treatment as well. How do you respond to that?
With all due respect to my colleague, there was no competent evidence presented to the circuit court that challenges the undisputed evidence Hazleton put forward that whether you dub this alcohol dependence or alcohol abuse, their treatment would have been the same.
Well, isn't there an affidavit that contradicts that?
In fact, there were no affidavits submitted. What the plaintiff submitted to the district court was a letter from Scott Hansen, who is another chemical evaluator and treatment provider at another facility, who saw Mr. Recksteiner, you know, after he was done with the Hazleton treatment program. It is not what, and what Mr. Hansen says, and it's not an affidavit form, it's a letter. And what he says in the letter is that I've never treated somebody with an alcohol abuse diagnosis with inpatient treatment for 28 days. But there's no evidence in that letter that Hazleton would have done anything different. And that's a critical distinction, because Recksteiner acknowledges at page 12 of the reply brief that the purported fact issue is whether Hazleton would have provided different treatment if they had initially made a different diagnosis. And the evidence on that point is unequivocal. If you look at Jim Atkins' letter that he wrote at Mr. Recksteiner's strong request that we reconsider this diagnosis, he makes it very clear, Mr. Atkins does, that even with a different diagnosis of alcohol abuse rather than alcohol dependence, the 28-day inpatient treatment program followed up with aftercare would have been Hazleton's recommendation. And it's important to really look at that. And that letter is at the appendix at page 129. Because Atkins and the other people who have reassembled to evaluate the diagnosis looked specifically at Dr. Recksteiner's own reports to Hazleton that not only did he regularly drink on call, he performed surgery after drinking. And what Jim Atkins says there is that crosses the line between normal and problematic drinking. So the short answer to my long response was that there's no affidavit evidence, and that is it's not competent evidence. There was no weighing of the evidence here by the circuit court or the appellate court. The courts did what courts do every day. Is there competent evidence to oppose summary judgment? And the answer here is no, there was not.
Do we look at the Hazleton letter but not look at the other letter? Or don't we look at either letter? Because there are no affidavits, I gather.
You're absolutely right, Justice Abramson, and I understand there was no affidavit. I think the court should look at the Atkins letter only because that is the sole basis of Mr. Recksteiner's claim of negligent diagnosis. So to the extent they've been relying on it, then we are relying on it as well, and it indicates very clearly that the treatment would have been the same.
I'm going to look at paragraph 26 of the Court of Appeals at the Appendix 109. The only claim against Hazleton was malpractice for misdiagnosis. And I'm going to ask Mr. Drill if that's true, because I hear him saying it's misdiagnosis and negligence in their treatment. Then it says, we are not convinced the statute is broad enough to encompass a Med-Mal claim. I read that to mean they're making no decision on that. How do you read that?
That's exactly how I read it. All they found they didn't need to reach that, basically.
Right. They say, okay, we conclude that Med-Mal would be, in any event, unsustainable. Now, here's my question to you. I hear your position is saying that the diagnosis and evaluation falls under 1G.
Correct.
I also hear you as recognizing that once they start treatment, they may not be under 1G.
I think it would depend on the facts presented.
Okay.
It could.
It could, because, so the facts here, easy to deal with something else, but the evaluation is, I think you gave an example of a tremor. And so they've evaluated that this is a diagnosis of tremor, and then they're going to treat this tremor, which might be surgery on some nerves to stop the tremor and yet keep functioning of the hand. And so they do the surgery, and your doctor, patient now, consents to that surgery, and they do the wrong hand, wrong nerves, anything. I want to make it absolutely clear that this is negligence. Okay. Do you think that negligent treatment is covered under 1G?
I don't think it would be for a couple of reasons. I don't think, frankly, that that surgeon would even stand up and tell a court that I was acting in good faith when I did this.
Well, he was.
As part of...
They make mistakes, well, just like everybody else. I'm doing the best I can, and I made a mistake. That's human.
What I don't think the person would say is, I was acting in good faith in furtherance of the review, and we can go to the statutory
okay.
language.
That goes to whether or not the treatment is in further of review. So you can separate... Under this statute, you can separate diagnosis and treatment. So the misdiagnosis, if there was one, would be covered under the peer review and evaluation, if I understand your argument.
Correct.
But the treatment might not be.
I think it depends. I think the treatment in this case would be covered. And the other point I would make...
Why? Why is it any different than the tremor case I gave you?
Because the treatment, there's no argument here that the treatment itself was inappropriate, that there was
Let's
any negligence.
Let's accept that it is for the moment. Let's accept that it is, because part of your argument and part of Mr. Drill's argument is that determination shouldn't have been made by the trial court without a jury. So let's accept for the moment that this treatment is different for abuse and dependency.
That the treatment is
yeah.
was incorrect.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Let's accept that.
Then again, I think you need to focus on the language of the statute, okay. the good faith, the furtherance, and in this particular case, this treatment was part and parcel of making the evaluation, his success with the treatment, his response to the treatment was part and parcel of the evaluation of whether Spooner could let him back in the door or not, whether he would pose a risk to patients, or whether, in fact, with the treatment and with his cooperation and with his performance through the treatment process, whether it was going to improve the quality of the services he provided to patients.
That's true of the tremor, too.
The tremor, again, I would disagree. That goes farther out, and I think the surgeon would say, I'm not evaluating or reviewing anything. I am fixing a medical injury in a different kind of way.
Counselor, I have a question, so I can't let you escape quite so quickly. Was the letter from Hazleton submitted to the trial court as part of an affidavit?
It would have been part of a procedural affidavit, yes.
Okay, in mm-hmm. support of the motion for summary judgment?
Correct.
Okay, and as a response to that, the plaintiff submitted a letter, two letters, but not as part of an affidavit. Is that correct?
I believe they were probably submitted to a procedural affidavit as
What's
well.
What's a procedural affidavit?
Well, the affidavit the lawyer saying attached is a copy of, as opposed to the affidavit of
the person
Mr. Hansen
the
saying, these are my opinions, this is what I've done.
So there wasn't a statement on either side based on personal knowledge. That's what I was trying to
There was not an affidavit on either side.
Okay, thank you.
Both are affidavits, or neither is an affidavit.
I would say neither are affidavits. I think.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mr. Drill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
May it please the court. Addressing these letters, the trial court accepted and discussed the letters on both sides.
Was there any objection to the use of these letters without an affidavit of personal knowledge?
Absolutely not.
Thank you.
I think it might be fair to answer the question about the alcohol counselor's letter. It may have been attached, as counsel used the term, to Dr. Recksteiner's affidavit. It may have been, I don't know. But the point is, both lower courts looked at these documents, discussed them, and I think this question about whether it was an affidavit or not is non-existent. Nobody ever raised it before. So, all we say about the letters is, if you read a letter submitted by Hazelden, which is obviously a self-serving letter by a party to the action, if you read that and you read the other letters from the other counselors, you'll see that there's a genuine issue of fact. The Court of Appeals did say that they were not convinced that the statute covered medical negligence. There isn't any question about their holding, because then they went on to say, however, we can do something else. And they did it. They weighed the evidence and said, we lose on causation. That's what I said earlier was inappropriate for a trial judge to do, or for a court of appeals to do. But so much for that.
Mr.
I'm on rebuttal now. Spooner Hospital knew before this snowmobile accident occurred that Hans Recksteiner occasionally would drink alcohol while on call. There's no dispute about that whatsoever. I think in the record it refers to some concern they had about his pager. He was wearing his pager when he would have a beer, for example. So there isn't any question but what they knew that Hans Recksteiner drank while on call. It's asserted by, I think, the last presentation that he did surgery. The inference was while under the influence. I don't know where that comes from.
Counselor, I want to bring you back to the malpractice again, because sure. For me it's the stickiest issue. In order to maintain a medical malpractice claim, you have to have a physician that's willing to testify that the care that was given to the patient is below the usual and customary standard of care for the illness or the injury. I don't see anything that looks like that in this record.
In most cases, that's true. What you said is true, except in situations where it's res ipsa. But we're not talking about that issue here.
We are talking about it because you're maintaining a claim for negligent treatment, and it's.
No.
You're not.
We're
okay.
Not.
All
we're,
right.
We are making a claim for negligent diagnosis.
Okay, there, so you're not saying there's anything wrong with the treatment then?
We did not say there was anything wrong with the treatment except that it was unnecessary.
Okay.
It all wasn't right. Negligent.
Okay. Yeah. I gotcha. Thank
okay.
you very much.
All right. So, to conclude, this issue about whether Hazelden was conducting a peer review, they were treating this person. I don't mean treating medically, but I mean they were getting paid to evaluate someone, just like the scores of people down the hall from Dr. Recksteiner. They did the same thing with Dr. Recksteiner they did for all of their customers. They did an evaluation, and then they provided treatment thereafter.
Counsel, I think there's a difference between the question of whether or not they conducted a review or evaluation of the services or whether or not they participated in the review. The Court of Appeals really emphasized, I think, the word in the statute that they participated in the review along with Spooner. Can you address what to do with that word? Sure. Didn't they participate in Spooner's general review?
I can address that. In peer review, true peer review, sometimes the facility or the group that starts it doesn't have the capability of reviewing the care of a physician given to his patients or hers. You can employ someone else to help out. And those people, in a true peer review, can participate, can review the services of the doctor, and can enjoy immunity. We don't quarrel with that, all right? Hazelden did not review Hans Recksteiner's competence in the treatment of his patients. He was nothing more than a customer for Hazelden. The only peer review, even anything that came close to a peer review, was Hazelden's own review of their own actions with the discovery that they misdiagnosed him. That's the only review of anything that Hazelden was doing. They were doing the same thing for Recksteiner as they did for any other customer. I will close by saying this. There was not a single physician involved in this so-called peer review. Who ever heard of a peer review of the competence of a doctor? It's a rhetorical question. Without there being one doctor involved in the review to judge whether or not this physician was competent. Not a single one. This whole proceeding was brought about by an accusation of alcohol dependency disputed by Dr. Recksteiner. And how ironic is it that it turns out that he was right, that he was not alcohol dependent?
Counsel, I don't understand.
I'm sorry?
I don't understand what your damages on misdiagnosis can be unless that misdiagnosis was followed by treatment that affected the doctor.
There was treatment, but I don't think you mean it in that sense.
If you'd stand before them.
As a result of the diagnosis,
as a result
he
of
was
the
treated.
Right. And as a result of the treatment, he lost wages.
Yes.
Right? So you're... Seems to me your claim has to be both for misdiagnosis and treatment based on a misdiagnosis is treatment that wasn't needed.
Well, that's true. But when I said before that we weren't complaining that a certain treatment on a certain day after the evaluation was wrong or he was given a wrong drug or anything like that. But certainly the treatment was unnecessary.
Okay, so if the doctor very, very carefully and very well cut off the wrong leg, may not be malpractice because the surgery was not negligently done, but having misdiagnosed which leg it was, you got a problem,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
That would be a malpractice case.
Yes.
Because that it perfectly done, but totally unnecessary.
Yes.
Okay, I just didn't understand your argument. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Drill. Thank you, Ms. Bjorkman and Ms. Ferguson, for your arguments today in a different kind of medical malpractice case and raising the issue of immunity. Thank you. We are concluding our hearing in 06-AP-1521, Rex Steiner versus Hazelden. The court will take a few moments recess so that those students who wish to leave may do so, and I believe we have more students coming in. We are in recess.